This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The botched execution of an Oklahoma death row inmate recently has affected New Hampshire's debate over capital punishment. In late April, Oklahoma prisoner Clayton Lockett was supposed to die by lethal injection, but the drugs didn't work correctly. Several minutes into the process, he regained consciousness and, after struggling for half an hour, died of a heart attack. The story captured national attention, including in the Granite State, where capital punishment opponents called it yet another piece of evidence that the death penalty needs to be put behind us. And so, even though their last repeal effort was tabled by the state Senate a month ago, last week a coalition of House lawmakers attached repeal onto another unrelated bill and sent the issue back over to the state Senate again. Today in The Exchange, we look at this final attempt to take capital punishment off the books. And later, New Hampshire gets closer to establishing buffer zones around abortion clinics. But first, let's hear from you on this death penalty issue. Do you feel this is an appropriate punishment or not? How much do you think public opinion on this has changed, if at all? And how about your own views? And what do you make of this latest last-minute effort for repeal? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there if you'd like. We've got three guests with us for the hour. Nancy Stiles joins us by phone. She's a Republican state senator from District 24, which includes the Seacoast area. Senator Stiles, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Lauren. Thanks for letting me call in.
Also with us, Rennie Cushing, Democratic representative from Hampton, longtime opponent of the death penalty and executive director of Murder Victims Families for Human Rights. And Representative Cushing, good to have you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Well, and Representative Cushing, I want to start with you. As I said, the latest repeal effort failed about a month ago with the Senate tying and then tabling this repeal bill. Why are you guys back again?
Well, you spoke at the outset, the botched execution in Oklahoma, I think, resonated throughout the country and also in New Hampshire. I had a state representative who came up to me afterwards and said that that made him rethink his vote. He had voted to keep the death penalty a couple months ago, but he had changed his mind. And I think it prompted a reexamination of what the death penalty is in reality, the idea that we're kind of conducting some kind of experiment as we're putting somebody to death is really kind of it's dehumanizing, and it reflects poorly upon us as people. So we thought it would be appropriate to revisit the issue. And so the 2 weeks ago, the Criminal Justice Committee voted to amend a bill and send it to the floor of the House. The House overwhelmingly, once again, 2-1. Voted to support repeal, and it's on its way to the Senate.
And this was an unrelated bill. It's a bill redefining the crime of burglary.
It was a housekeeping bill that adds three words to the burglary statute. And we're really clear that we're trying to recognize that the death penalty is a really difficult issue. We wrestle with it in the legislature. We wrestle with it in larger society. And we were conscious as we were amending this minor bill that would be an appropriate vehicle by which there could be a conversation in the Senate and in the House.
Senator Stiles, do you think this story from Oklahoma changed some feelings about the death penalty in New Hampshire?
Well, no, I'm not sure that it did. It was a horrible thing that happened out there, and currently the state and federal government are doing a review of how and why this happened. As you know, that day was a very difficult day for all of us in the Senate, and I just think that reviewing it again is going to bring up the same issues all over again, and I don't think it will change anyone's mind.
So despite this headline, the issue for you remains the same. And just remind us some of your feelings, Senator Stiles, on this issue, why you support the death penalty.
Well, New Hampshire has a small and defined list of crimes that meet the criteria for capital punishment. And since we have not executed anyone since 1939, which suggests that issuing of the sentence is done with the most diligent of scrutiny. And there were many lenses that the jury is required to look through before they consider such a ruling.
We're very careful with the death penalty, it's often said, Gary Reyno. Just remind us what people say when they say, hey, New Hampshire statute is narrowly drawn. That's the term that we often hear.
Well, there are very few crimes that you can commit that will give you the death penalty as a sentence. I mean, it's killing a law enforcement officer of any kind, a judicial officer. Committing a home invasion is another. That's the most recent addition to the death penalty. Inmates who commit murder when they're in prison, for example. But it's a very much more narrower than many, many, many other states that do have it. So it is a very narrow list of people. But, I mean, and we haven't had anyone on death row until recently, which is why all of a sudden we have a much more interest, I think, because it cuts both ways. So all of a sudden we have somebody on death row.
Makes it more real, doesn't it?
It makes it more real, both for opponents and for those who want to maintain repeal.
And I asked Senator Stiles and Representative Cushing about the Oklahoma headline again about a month ago. Have you heard anything, Gary? Did this really change the debate or not much here in the Granite State?
The debate that they had last week was very similar to the one that was had earlier, except for the argument that some were making, which was that actually it's the opponents who are responsible, death penalty opponents who are responsible for the botched execution, because they're the ones that convinced the European drug makers not to sell these drugs in the United States anymore, which I thought was kind of stretching it a little bit. But, I mean, it was about the only new argument that we were hearing.
Well, again, you can join us with your thoughts, new or old. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here in the exchange. 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the death penalty again this hour. What the matter seems settled for the year, but there's a new effort, one last attempt to repeal the death penalty after a botched execution in Oklahoma. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at NHP. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Representative Cushing, I heard a report just this morning that one state senator is a little frustrated that you guys are bringing this back yet again. Senator O'Dell told our colleague Norma Love at the Associated Press, look, you know, we already voted on this. We're done. So he sounds like he's going to vote against you this time around, even though the last time he voted in favor of repeal.
Well, I think that, as we said, this is a difficult issue, but we can't ignore it. And I think the conversation has to continue. I thought it was interesting about Oklahoma. One thing that struck me about that is that the representative who sponsored the first lethal injection bill was a Republican representative from Oklahoma. That's where it began in this. We used that method. And he's somebody who, as he saw it played out, came to change his position on the death penalty. So he actually came to oppose capital punishment because he saw that what he thought would have been a humane way to put someone to death was anything but. And that's the kind of there's a constant theme in this, and that's people, the more you learn about the death penalty, the more you understand its flaws. And what we've constantly seen are people changing their perception. Perspective.
What do you think about the idea, though, that putting this attempt in at the last minute, attaching it onto an unrelated bill, has not helped your cause?
Well, I think that in New Hampshire, this is just—it's part of how we, you know, the legislature's in session. We do our work all the time, and it's certainly a germane bill. It's a position that had been adopted by the House, and it's back to have this. You know, the Senate can dispose of it how, you know, it chooses. But I think it's legitimate that we have a conversation about it.
Gary, go ahead, and then I want to go to our listeners.
Well, I think the Senate already has done what it's going to do, which was put the contents of the bill that they had amended on another bill. They did that last week. So it may be a very short discussion of the death penalty and just be kill the bill off and be done with it.
All right. Let's go to our listeners, see what they think. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're getting your thoughts, questions, comments about New Hampshire's death penalty statute and whether this is an appropriate punishment or not to have on our books, whether public opinion has changed on this at all, including your own opinion. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Chris is calling from Kittery, Maine. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi there, panel. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My view is we hear all this wah, wah, wah about these prisoners in death row going through this, you know, horrendous. They've been given the wrong injection. It's taken them so long to die. I believe the guy in question murdered, I believe it was a 16-year-old, strangled her, and then buried her alive. You know, it's like, it's like, to me, it's pathetic that people are going on about these prisoners' rights. Why don't they look at the victims, the victims' rights, you know?
Well, Chris, thanks for the call. I want to get Senator Stiles' thoughts on this. Sorry to interrupt you there, Chris, but he's making the point, Senator Stiles, and I wonder what you think, that, you know, there's so much emphasis on the people who are on death row and the struggles of this Oklahoma man, inmate. What about the victims?
Well, I tend to agree somewhat with the person that's calling in. As you know, during this deliberation, I spoke with several victims. I spoke with religious people. I spoke with the advocates. I spoke with several different people before this vote came to the floor. And in that whole process, I said to myself, I might be willing to consider a discussion about expanding it for those that torture and murder children. I mean, there are some just crimes that are so horrific that they need to go through this filter of consideration and to keep that tool on the books for us to go to when it's absolutely necessary.
Well, and Representative Cushing, when we talk about victims, I mean, you're a victim, too. Your father was murdered.
My father and my brother-in-law were murdered, and I know hundreds of family members of murder victims who oppose the death penalty. And there's a diversity of opinion within the victim-survivor population. But one of the things that the caller pointed out to me is what I dislike about the death penalty is that it makes rock stars out of killers. We put a whole lot of focus on someone who has done a very heinous thing and raised their profile, and victims get lost in the conversation. And that's one of the things that I bring to this discussion all the time is let's not forget victims.
Okay. Well, Chris, thank you for calling us. Good to hear from you. You can join us with your questions, comments, thoughts on the death penalty here in the Exchange. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR earned 4 Edward R. Murrow Awards for Outstanding Journalism this year, as well as a Gracie Award honoring excellent programming produced by women. You can hear the award-winning entries at our award-winning website, nhpr.org. More on One More Try to Repeal the Death Penalty in New Hampshire on The Exchange at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, what election results in India mean for the country's future and the world economy. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Geriatric Psychiatry Services at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, specializing in mental and behavioral health for people 65 and older in outpatient or inpatient settings, frisbeehospital.com. From the Woodstock Inn, Station, and Brewery, featuring its 170-seat function room for private parties, weddings, and other special events, woodstockinnnh.com. And Verizon Wireless Arena in Manchester, presenting Cher September 13th as part of her Dress to Kill tour. Tickets available today at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at one last attempt to take the death penalty off the books here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Tell us how you feel about the death penalty, how much you think perhaps public opinion on this has changed, perhaps not. If your own views are changing and evolving, let's hear from you on that. And what do you make of this last-minute effort to repeal the death penalty in the legislature? The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Nancy Stiles joins us by phone, Republican State Senator. Rennie Cushing is here in studio, Democratic Representative from Hampton, along with Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, we were talking about how one headline from Oklahoma has affected this death penalty debate here in New Hampshire. I want to ask you all about another news event that may have some bearing bearing on this discussion, and that's the terrible shooting death of a Brentwood police officer, Stephen R. Kell. How, Senator Stiles, if at all, is this being brought up in the death penalty debate?
Well, I believe that the I'm sure that we'll find out, but I believe that the person who killed the officer was also killed either in the fire or was shot at some point during that whole episode. It's terrible. It's a horrific thing. The death of anyone, whether it is, intentional or unintentional, is a very emotional and difficult thing to discuss and talk about. But I do think that, we have a very small and defined list of crimes, and I do think it's important to keep that tool on the books, because the officers can also use it to identify other information when they are interrogating the individual. So,
well, and you hear police officers, Senator Stiles, often say, look, having capital punishment on the books offers us some measure of protection. Criminals know that they're going to get the ultimate punishment if they kill a police officer. But that didn't seem to stop the man who killed Officer Arkell. So does it offer that measure of protection?
You asking me that question,
yes,
Laura?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I am on the phone. I think anyone who sets out to kill anyone is going to do it anyway. But as I said, it's important to keep tools on the books that will help us come to a solution of anything. I don't see the sense of getting rid of tools that we have to determine outcomes of any events, and that's the reason we have laws.
So another tool on the books for prosecutors, for them to work with these cases in a broader way? Is that what you're saying, Senator Stiles?
Right. I think if you recall out in Seattle, the Seattle Times, when they were talking about the Green River killer, they were able to identify 49 counts of murder because they had the tool on the books for the penalty of the death penalty, and they were able to trade that with him for life without parole and get all of these other cases resolved.
Okay. Representative Cushing, I want to hear from that. I've heard others say that as well, that it helps to solve crimes.
I mean, that points to one of the whole failures, the brokenness of our death penalty system, because here you have somebody who acknowledged that he had killed 49 people, who gets life, and then you have somebody who unintentionally, with less culpability, ends up getting the death penalty when they commit a homicide. There's a certain randomness about that. I'm not going to defend any homicide, but the idea that we'd use, that we need to have, the law enforcement needs as a hammer, if you will, or some kind of a tool to coerce people to provide information, I don't think it works that way. Certainly that's not what former Attorney General Phil McLaughlin talked about when he testified before the legislature.
Let's go to some calls, all of you. Yeah, go ahead, Senator Stiles. Go ahead, Senator Stiles. Yeah.
I said it did work for them in Seattle, right?
Nancy, it didn't work there.
Well, let's agree to disagree on that one, it sounds like. But we do have some calls who want to jump in our conversation. So let's go to Bill in Canaan. And Bill, thanks for waiting.
Sure, my pleasure. Good morning.
Morning.
In my mind, and emotionally, I'm on the fence about this. I go back and forth. But intellectually and ethically, to me, it's not an issue of the appropriateness of society being vindictive or vengeful, or even it being disincentive to murders, because most of them are emotionally driven in the moment. What concerns me is what kind of society we are, and I don't think we want to be a vindictive and vengeful society, which is why, even though emotionally I go back and forth on individual cases, I think systemically and ethically I am against against capital punishment.
So, Bill, it's interesting because a lot of people either firmly feel one way or firmly feel the other way. What makes you go back and forth?
My emotions. Emotions are so variable. And that's true both for perpetrators, victims, and our society. So I go back and forth because I can find compassion for the victims, and so are therefore inclined to say, well, I'll give them what they deserve, and who cares how much they suffer, and that sort of thing, like the fellow with the Scottish accent said earlier on. But the ethical dimension of me says we don't want to be like them, that is to say, like the perpetrators. We don't want to be a society that's vengeful, vindictive, and driven by negative emotion.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Bill. Good, interesting thoughts there. What do you think, Senator Stiles? We don't want to be like them.
I don't call it vengeful. I think it goes through the judicial system, and that process is something that we have always lived with.
So there's a...
there's a judicial process, and
sure.
There is justice that is a result of the jury system.
So people have their passions, they have their anger, but you're saying, Senator Stiles, the judicial process helps sort of sort through that.
It does.
Gary, I want to ask you something. Again, I thought it was real interesting that our caller says he goes back and he's gone back and forth on this issue. In your many years of covering the legislature, how much do you see lawmakers going back and forth, or are people pretty much pro or anti?
You know, I think there's a core of people that are pro and anti, and then there are people who are switching. I mean, I think this last time through, and I know Rennie will back me up on this, I mean, there were three people in the Criminal Justice Committee, which Rennie sits on, including the longtime chairman or the chairman who's been a longtime supporter of the death penalty, whose son-in-law was killed in the Greenland incident, Laura Panalakis. And she voted with Rennie for repeal. I mean... the House Majority Leader, Steve Sirleaf, I mean, again, a U.S. Marshal, he changed his mind. Dennis Fields, a longtime supporter, they changed their mind. I mean, people change their mind, but, I mean, there's a large core, one way or the other, that doesn't really change. But there are those people that are moving one way or the other.
Okay. Well, again, Bill, thanks for that call. The number here in the exchange for you to join us with your thoughts on this tough topic is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Catherine's calling from Derry. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to talk about the deterrent issue. And people talk about how it can't be used as a deterrent. They think that people who commit crimes are emotional and passionate and not without any thinking about what they're doing. I don't think that's the case. Now, I'm a violent crime survivor myself, and perhaps that shades my opinion on this, or maybe it informs it. I think that there's no way for you to go and find out for certain how much of a deterrent it is, because do you really expect people that commit murder to be honest with you about this, or who have thought about it and then decided not to be honest with you about it? That's probably not scientifically possible.
So, Catherine, you're in favor of the death penalty as a possible deterrent. Is that what you're saying?
I think that a lot of people who have not been survivors of a violent crime don't really appreciate how common-looking and how normal-looking people who wish them such ill will, how they look and how they think. I think that people don't have any clue how evil these people are and how easily they would blend in and look like something different. And I actually would not want to live in a state without the death penalty. I don't think that we abuse it in New Hampshire. That would change my opinion, too. If I thought that people who were defendants were not treated fairly, I would be of a different opinion, that we should put it on the table and not have any executions until that got cleaned up. But I don't want to live in a society where I feel like they don't take seriously the issue of violent crime against innocent people.
Well, Catherine, hard to share your story. Thank you so much for calling in. Really appreciate it. And Randy, what do you think about what she says?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm very sorry for her victimization. I'm glad she's a survivor. I think that the death penalty is not a deterrent. If the death penalty was a deterrent, Houston, Texas would be the safest place in the country because Harris County sends more people to death row than any other jurisdiction. And I don't think when the idea that we can live without the death penalty is something that, you know, most countries in the world have come to realize. We end up with the death penalty in the company of countries like, you know, China and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq. And that's not a place where our country or our state really wants to be with a...
Well, Catherine, thank you for sharing your story again. And again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. This gets to what we talked about a little bit earlier, Senator Stiles. New Hampshire does use this sparingly. It's narrowly drawn, as Catherine, our caller, says. Did you want to jump in on that as well, Senator Stiles?
That's the exact reason why I believe we should keep it on the books. I mean, it is a narrowly drawn statute.
Here's go ahead, Senator Stiles. Yeah.
No, and I think, you know, when it goes through the judicial system, they often err on the side of life in prison.
Here's a tweet that we got.
I see no reason to take it off the books at this time.
Thank you, Catherine, for the call. Here's a tweet that came in earlier from Fran, who says, there was a time when unnecessary spending was a concern of our elected officials. Death penalty costs big bucks. Why keep it? Gary Reno, does the financial argument play into New Hampshire's arguments about the death penalty?
I don't really think so. I mean, it's going to be expensive for the correction system to do the things that they have to do if we keep going forward with the death sentence for Michael Addison. But I don't think that really is much of an issue when lawmakers have been debating it. It's the ethics and the moral issues that have dominated.
It's come up in other states, though, Gary.
It has
right?
In
the
other
cost,
states.
Yeah.
It certainly has. But in New Hampshire, I mean, it hasn't really, because we don't really know what it is going to cost.
But for many victims' family members who, like the 120 unsolved homicides, who have family members of the 120 unsolved homicides, they look at it from a perspective of, you know, the state choosing to put resources on a very finite number of cases while not spending any resources to really help meet the needs of victims of crime. And that's, we just don't do as much as we should be doing to meet the needs of all crime victims.
What do you think, Senator Stiles? Is there an economic argument against the death penalty, that it costs the state a lot of money to carry these out?
And that's true, and that goes through the appeals process. And I'm not sure if Rennie is suggesting that we reduce the appeals process in that and focus some more money on the victims.
No, I'm just saying that, you know, we spend very little money. Up until last July 1st, we spent zero general fund dollars to work on the 120 unsolved cold cases, homicides in the state. And at the same time, we're spending millions of dollars to pursue one case.
Let's go back to our callers. Dennis joins us from Manchester. Hi, Dennis. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
I'm pulling into work right now, which makes things a little difficult. But I was wondering if your panel ever thought about the jury system and the way it is set up. I've sat on two sexual assault cases, one in New Hampshire, one in Massachusetts. And by far, the individual in Massachusetts was clearly guilty, and we came back with a guilty cause. What I'm wondering is, the one in New Hampshire turned out to be something where, when we all couldn't decide and you need all the people involved in the jury to agree, we were dismissed very summarily, and we were basically, the premise was the DA and the judge were quite upset with the fact that we couldn't come together on a guilty plea, clearly. And they said, fine, we'll just retry it again. And, you know, I mean, with O.J. Simpson, they just continued to retry him and retry him, you know, and eventually they took everything he had, which wasn't right or wrong. I don't make a decision on that.
So, Dennis, but how does your experience serving on these juries affect your feelings about the death penalty?
As far as the death penalty is concerned, quite frankly, I think it's a waste of time. I mean, with the appeals, you're talking maybe 15, 20 years before the individual is put to death. And I feel that if especially you have a relatively young individual, you're talking about an enormous amount of time in jail for life.
Getting back to Fran's point about the money involved and people are in jail for a long, long time and so forth, the process is really stretched out. And some people feel sort of cynical about that, Senator Stiles. I wonder what you think, that, you know, people are on death row for decades.
Right. I think we perhaps need to look at the appeal process and see if there is something we can do. I think that we have the tools now through DNA to more accurately find, you know, tie a person to a crime than we might have had, you know, 30 years ago. So I think maybe this is an opportunity for us to look at those statutes as well.
There's two other issues that often come up with the death penalty that I'd like to ask you all about. One is, Representative Cushing, the fear that life in prison really isn't life in prison, that if we don't have the death penalty, eventually people who have done unspeakable things, terrible crimes, will be let out. So, you know, there's this concern that if you replace the death penalty with life in prison, really bad people could get out.
But that doesn't happen. There's since the states began sentencing people to life without parole, no one has ever been released who's been sentenced for murder and to that has ever been released from out into the general public. In New Hampshire, the only way you can get out of a life without parole sentence is to receive a pardon from the governor, and that's not going to happen. That just doesn't happen. I think there was a time when people committed murder were sentenced to life, but that wasn't real life. That would be 45 years, and I think that was the fear. And that's what, you know, when Texas finally became the last state to do life without parole, and what you see is death sentences dropping because jurors don't have that lingering concern that if they sentence someone to life that they'll get out of, and they'll kill somebody.
One last question for you, Senator Stiles, and this kind of taps into what Dennis, our caller, was saying, the fear that once in a while mistakes happen, juries make mistakes, people get things wrong, and that the state of New Hampshire might actually kill an innocent person. This is a concern on the other side that we hear about. What do you think, Senator Stiles?
Well, I think since we haven't really put anyone to death since 1939, and I think our juries do an excellent job in the review process as they go through it. They use all of the tools that they have to and look through all of those lenses that are required through RSA 650. I don't think we've made any mistakes in New Hampshire. I don't know of anyone that has been maybe Rennie can correct me, but I'm not sure that there's been anyone that has been released that was put in jail for life without parole because they were found innocent afterwards.
And Gary Reno, real quick, just preview what's going to happen in the legislature on this.
Well, the Senate's coming back next week for one last session, and the bill will be coming up, which the House attached the death penalty to. As I said before, how much debate it gets remains to be seen because they've attached the contents of that bill to some other bill. So we'll see what happens. But if we're going to have a debate about it again, it will be next week before the Senate.
Okay. Well, and Gary Reno will be staying with us for our next segment as we look at the possibility that New Hampshire will require buffer zones around abortion clinics. Senator Stiles and Representative Cushing, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Nancy Stiles, Republican state senator from District 24, and Rennie Cushing, Democratic representative from Hampton. As I said, coming back in just a moment, we'll talk about the possibility of buffer zones around abortion clinics in the Granite State. We'll hear from a supporter and opponent on this issue. So keep it right here on The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, what India's election results mean for the country's future and the world economy. Then, a conversation with Jim Webb, former U.S. Senator, Navy Secretary, and Combat Marine. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats, providing evaluations and surgical interventions for athletic injuries, sosmed.org. And the Clean Bedroom, Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. For the rest of the hour, we're talking about the possibility of buffer zones around abortion clinics and whether they'll soon be required in the Granite State. Gary Reno is with us from the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And joining us by phone is Laura Tebow, Executive Director for NARAL Pro-Choice New Hampshire. Laura, welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Brian McCormick, Executive Director of Cornerstone, a conservative public policy think tank. And Brian, welcome back. Good to have you, too.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Well, and Gary Reno, put this in the bigger picture for us, please. How widely are these buffer zones used elsewhere?
They're not particularly widely used. I mean, the one that has gotten a lot of attention is in Massachusetts, where it's currently being challenged before the U.S. Supreme Court. They've had their buffer zone for quite some time, And this New Hampshire law is largely based on the Massachusetts law.
And yet now Massachusetts is before the U.S. Supreme Court, as you said, Gary. And there are some people who said, look, maybe New Hampshire should hold off on this issue until this Massachusetts
right.
case is decided.
And that's what some people were saying. It's time why are we doing this? Why are we going forward? We're just setting ourselves up for litigation. But the House and the Senate decided to go forward because of what's been going on, largely in Manchester at the Planned Parenthood clinic.
And to you, I think, Laura Thibault, what has been going on in Manchester around that clinic that prompted this legislation?
Sure. Well, we have seen an increase of activity outside of reproductive health centers, not just in Manchester, but around the state. And things are heating up. I want to remind us all that there's no other medical procedure for which you have to endure public shaming and intimidation before receiving. And certainly we don't want even one incidence of violence against a provider or a patient or even a protester when things heat up outside of reproductive health centers. There's real concern that someone's going to get hurt. So, we're going to have to wait and see what the Supreme Court decides. But in the meantime, New Hampshire legislators, they've stepped up. They've done what needed to be done for women in our state. And I think it's hard to expect legislators to wait when the safety of their constituents is at risk.
Well, and heated language is one thing, but violence is another. As you point out, Laura, have there been violent incidents around any of the clinics in New Hampshire?
Sure. We have a history of arson attacks, death threats. As long as abortion has been legal and provided in the state, there are incidents, certainly not often, thankfully, but we have had several incidents.
In New Hampshire?
In New Hampshire.
Okay. Brian McCormick, what's wrong with buffer zones, keeping people back a certain distance so that the patients can get in? What do you think?
Well, again, thank you, Laura, for having me on. Really, this is about what it's taking away from them. If you look at people who go on strike, you look at picket lines, they beat scabbers as they come through the line, yet they're protected under their right to protest to do so. I'm going to follow up on what Laura said there in regards to there being violence in the state. I would question how many of those incidents came from people standing outside the actual clinics. I do understand that, yes, this is a controversial procedure, and again, we don't advocate for violence or action taken that way, anyway, shape, or form. That's completely deplorable, and I do believe it's the people who stand in front of the building's responsibility to keep them in line. But inside of that, I do believe that there's a federal statute that protects the clinics under, just basically giving them the right to take protections. It's never been enacted in the state, and that's at a federal level. But the broader issue is that this is taking the rights of those individuals who stand in front of these facilities away from them. We do have a First Amendment right to protest. And we've seen such controversial cases as the Westboro Baptist Church on some really tough subject matter where that was defended. And really the purpose of people standing in front of this place is, yes, it's a controversial opinion. It's different from those who are going in to partake in the procedure. But under the U.S. Constitution, we have a right to do so. And that's why you're seeing such backlash from this, and that's why we don't believe that it's right or constitutional in any way.
I want to invite our listeners again to join us. This part of our hour on The Exchange, we're talking about the possibility of New Hampshire imposing buffer zones around abortion clinics where protesters would have to stand back by a certain number of feet. The number here in The Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. How do you feel about these buffer zones and the possibility that they could become law here in New Hampshire? What's the balance between clinic safety, as one of our guests talks about, and First Amendment rights, as our other guest talks about? The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So as we talk about the First Amendment, which you raised, Brian McCormick, Laura Thibault, what do you think? I mean, people do have the right to oppose abortion and oppose it out there on the streets in front of the place where these this procedure is done.
Absolutely. Protesters have the right to express their opinion. This bill does nothing to hinder that right. Personally, I think it's unfortunate that protesters feel shouting at women is productive, but That's, again, that's their right, and this bill doesn't change their ability to do that. The hope of this bill is that by not allowing protesters to directly get right into the face of women and their support partners, is that the bill will help decrease some of the tension that's outside of reproductive health facilities and the risk of someone being hurt. So that's the hope. It's certainly not to take away anyone's right to their own opinion. It's not taking away the right of their ability to express that opinion, but it would create, you know, again, that's why it's called a buffer zone. It would create a little bit of a safety zone, a buffer zone around women who are accessing legal medical services, which is also a right.
Gary Reno, how much does the First Amendment free speech issue that Brian raises come up on the legislative floor?
It was prime front and center to a large extent,
particularly
in debate in the House. And in the Senate, too, it's not quite as much, but to some extent. I mean, it's a huge issue. I mean, what we're really talking here is balancing constitutional rights. I mean, you have the constitutional right to free speech, and yet you have the constitutional right to, if some people say, to be left alone. So, I mean, it's a whole argument of, do you get to cry fire in a crowded theater? Well,
no.
And, I mean, it's the same sort of balancing. It's a difficult question. It's a very difficult question.
When we talk about free speech, Brian, are there certain behaviors that go with that speech that make the speech no longer protected? As Gary said, you know, the famous fire in a crowded theater example. I mean, for example, if someone threatens violence or if they make that speech physically putting themselves in someone's way, is that free speech no longer protected? I'm just wondering where the lines are crossed.
And as Gary said, this is a very complicated issue. And I want to reiterate it. This is not in any way an attempt to protect people who behave as such. I've been down there, I've never seen interactions like that go on. Granted, I'm not there every day, so I don't know. I know that is not the intent nationally of those who believe as they do standing outside of these facilities. But if that is something that is constantly going on, I believe there's a better way to deal with it, and I believe that comes from within the community. Rather than push them 25 feet away. And now you're starting to get into, on top of your First Amendment argument, a buffer zone. As it's applied, if that starts to broaden to other private entities, you're talking about infringement on public space as well. This goes farther than just the First Amendment. You're talking about, you know, where does an entity, a corporation, have the ability to infringe on the rights to public space? I mean, that's a public sidewalk. They don't own that. You know, not to mention the neighbors. You know, people are in the surrounding area who have to deal with people on their sidewalks. You know, it's a very complicated matter. And as Gary referenced earlier, you know, they have made a decision hastily before other Supreme Court decisions have been made to determine what the real parameters of this type of argument are.
Let's take a call, if we could. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us as we look at the possibility of buffer zones around abortion clinics in New Hampshire is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let's go to Concord, where Rob is on the line. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say I'm a lifelong Roman Catholic, and I do not believe in abortion. I believe it's wrong. I would counsel a person to not have an abortion, but I do think it should remain legal, because I just think that there are people who, beyond their own circumstances, need to have one. And a couple weeks ago, in Mass, someone came and spoke at our church to announce that they were having a rally at an abortion clinic in Concord. Now, I had just moved back here after being away for a couple years, didn't know there was one in Concord. Not only did that person announce there was, where the rally was, but they specifically gave the address of where the clinic was. And I thought that was very irresponsible, because I thought that that put a target on every single employee of that clinic in Concord for anybody who wanted to hear where it was. And I just, you know, I just have a real hard time with that, because these employees of these clinics, they may not have the same political view. They're just there working. Who knows what their religious views are? And, you know, I just don't like the idea of making these people targets. And I really believe they are. Not to mention the people that go there for services other than abortion. And it really bothers me. And I really think that you need these buffer zones when you have these kind of threats, this kind of potential violence that could happen because we see what happens across the country.
So,
and I don't think that Packard's immune to that.
So, Rob, even though you personally are strongly opposed to abortion, you think
right.
the buffer zones are okay to protect people who are going to the clinic and who are working at the clinic?
Absolutely, because it boils down to the fact that this is a decision that each person must make between them and God, basically. They have to deal with the decision when they go see God someday.
Okay. Rob, thank you very much for calling in. What do you think about this, Brian? I want to hear from you first, but you also, Laura Tebow, and then I have another question for you, Gary. Yeah, go ahead, Brian. It's between an individual and the God that he says they will meet someday, and so leave it alone.
Well, again, you know, that's a true statement. However, it's really the principle here. You know, you're saying that you're not enacting on rights, but you don't see buffer zones in front of, you know, strikers. You don't see buffer zones for picket lines. You don't see buffer zones for places like this. Why is it that those who believe in something that's rather controversial in modern day culture, why is there a buffer zone for them? And yes, it is a personal decision between them and their God. But I mean, this is something that's been protected by our country. It's something that our forefathers believed was necessary to an open and democratic republic, And I don't see how that this discrimination to this particular community is acceptable, even though that is an individual choice. It's just as much of an individual choice to cross that picket line, but we protect them.
You know, Laura, this is an interesting point that Brian raises, and others have raised it too. You know, why just pick on protesters around abortion clinics? Why not other types of protesters? You know, animal rights activists protesting a shop that sells fur coats, for example. Are you unfairly targeting one type of protester over another?
I think what New Hampshire legislators are doing are answering a problem that's unique, you know, that's happening in New Hampshire. It's happening across the country. There's documented incidents of violence happening all over this country around this issue. It's deeply divisive, and women who are accessing these services and providers who work there need protection. Again, this bill was very carefully crafted to balance two separate rights, and this does absolutely nothing to take away the right of those who want to stand outside of reproductive health clinics and voice their opinion, but it does provide a little bit of privacy and protection for those who are accessing legal services. So I think it's a real balance. I think it was very, very thoughtfully done, and I don't believe that it's picking on one group of people. I think that it's a call to answer and hopefully prevent incident of violence happening in New Hampshire. We can't afford to have that happen here, not even one, and we see it happen again and again across the country. So I don't think that we can pretend that it's not happening, because unfortunately it is.
Well, and Gary, as May, the end of May approaches, the legislature is getting out early this year, June
yes.
5th or 6th, I think is the day. So where does this abortion clinic buffer zone bill stand right now?
It has passed the Senate, and last week it passed the House. But the House made a change in it, which requires the coordination with local communities, that the facilities coordinate a little better. They have to coordinate with local communities and the police department and so on, and how they're setting up. They define the zone more precisely. And so it will have to go back to the Senate. It probably will get through the Senate fairly easily. It did before, because it's not a major change. And then it will be going to the governor.
So some technical changes.
Technical changes. And then the Senate will have to take some action this week. And then it will be going to the governor.
Now, the Senate is Republican controlled. Is it surprising that the Senate voted in favor of this buffer zone?
It doesn't. This has not been a largely a partisan issue. It's been more a moral issue. And that's when you get into the moral issues, the partisanship tends to fade away.
Yeah. So what do you think, Brian McCormick? This bill sounds like it's going to go through. Sounds like Governor Hassan will sign it. Will you guys go to court over this? Wait to see what happens with the U.S. Supreme Court or what?
Yes, I do believe we will. I mean, we're watching the Supreme Court case very closely. But as this has become a constitutional issue, I do believe that you will see legal action from not only organizations like my own. There are a few national organizations I know that have taken notice of it, and a few other organizations within the state. I absolutely do believe that the states open themselves up for a lawsuit.
Okay. Laura Thibault, what do you think?
Well, we're confident that Governor Hassan will consider this bill with the same thoughtfulness that the majority of legislators did, and will continue to advocate for the privacy and protection of women in New Hampshire and providers in New Hampshire.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for helping us out with this topic. Brian McCormick, thanks for being with us. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Laura.
Brian McCormick, Executive Director of Cornerstone, a conservative public policy think tank. Laura Thibault, thank you also for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
Laura Thibault, Executive Director for NARAL Pro-Choice New Hampshire, and Gary Reno with us for both our death penalty conversation and our buffer zone conversation. Thank you for helping us out this
morning.
You're
most welcome, Laura.
That's Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation on the rising trend in childhood anxiety. We sit down with Lynn Lyons, New Hampshire-based therapist and co-author of the new book, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. We'll find out what she believes is driving this trend, what's considered normal worry and what's unhealthy, and the role parents play in their children's anxiety struggles. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
I am Ream Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from People's United Bank, helping businesses, small and large, grow to the next level in branches and online at peoples.com. And Cedar Crest Center for Children with Disabilities, comprehensive medical care and education for children with complex medical and developmental needs, ages infant to 21. CedarCrestCenter.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The presumptive prime minister of the world's largest democracy promised a shining India in his victory speech Friday. Narendra Modi's BJP party swept the country's national election in a landslide, the scale of which has not been seen since the 1980s.